told him if I could, I'd help him out. So here I am. Then he said, well, it will be a Sunday morning, and your speaker will be Virginia. Well, I didn't tell Bob at the time because I was so dumbfounded when he called, but Bob doesn't realize what an honor that it was to me to get to introduce Virginia. I met Virginia a few years back in Gettysburg. I had never met her before. And as Dennis said the other night, it was just like an instant friendship. And since that time, Virginia and my past have crossed many times. And I have come to know and love Virginia in a very special way. I'm not going to try to tell you her story. I'm going to let her do that. But I will tell you this, and they told me I had to keep it clean and honest. She's a very active member in Al-Anon. She's trustee, and she's just a lovable person, and we love her in West Virginia. So I'll give you Virginia.
A couple of people said to me, get on hell, and I said, no, I'm going to be good if it kills me. We'll see, though. My name is Virginia. I'm a member of the Queen City Al-Anon Family Group in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi.
And I'm glad to be here. This is a far cry from what Sunday mornings used to be like. A far cry. This is such a beautiful place, and I've had such a good time. And I do want to ask the committee and those responsible for extending the invitation to be here. I want to thank you for my coffee cup, and Buck, I hope you get one for each of the girls. Aside, you know, I thank you for the fruit that the committee put in our room to enjoy, and I do like to eat, and so I enjoyed that. And I'm very grateful for your presence here this morning. And if I can get out of the way, get self out of the way, what should be said will be said. Come through this mouth. Of course, that's been one of the biggest problems in my life, my mouth. And it would be all right if my mouth had always been used to say exactly what I thought and felt, but there were a lot of years it said things I didn't believe and didn't get anywhere close to what I was really thinking. So my mouth has been the source of a lot of trouble, and I don't have to look back the back to see my husband shaking his head. Yes. I do want to make one reference to the fact that Mary mentioned that I'm a trustee. I'm a trusted servant of the Al-Anon Family Groups. But lest any of you misunderstand, your trusted servants are not elevated in service. It's an expanded role in Al-Anon. And if you look up to find your trusted servants, you won't find them. But if you look out beside you, around you, you'll see them. And if you put any of your trusted servants up, you're unfair to yourselves and to them. In Al-Anon, we share our experience, strength, and hope also. And the only place to begin is in the beginning. And let's see, we've got all afternoon, so I can give you... I made arrangements in the dining room for them to bring lunch over here. Dear, I'm going to get in trouble, I'm afraid. You know, that's one thing I found out. I used to think I only was in trouble when things was a tragedy or when I was down. I find I can get in just as much trouble when I'm flying. So I have to care. I feel very much comfortable here, not only because of so many of you that I've met in other Al-Anon meetings and at AA things and all, but this isn't too far from where I spent a number of years. I was born on the eastern shore of Maryland, and when I was 7 years of age, I went to live with my maternal grandparents in Washington, PA. And, of course, we used to come down to West Virginia to a lot of things, vacations, trips, and the zoo of someplace in Wheeling. Jack, where's the zoo? You ought to know about the zoo. No, I'm not going to say. Anyhow. Very much at home here. You're the kind of people that I hope I'm like. You're down to earth, and you're honest, and you're fun, but you are willing to let people know how you really feel when you're touched and when you're moved. But when I moved to Pennsylvania, I had gone, it was our custom in the family for the grandchildren to visit the grandparents for a summer, a month each summer. And in that summer we went up, we didn't return to Maryland. I didn't know anything about the Depression, but the Depression had hit and there wasn't anything left. At that time, my mother left and my father died very shortly after from a heart condition. And I was to spend a great number of years wondering what was wrong with me that mother left. Now I know that there was a lot, I was very self-centered, and I had a great sense of responsibility for things I was not responsible for. Because I wasn't an only child, and I never thought what was wrong with my brothers, my sister, and I, that mother left. It was always what was wrong with me. I know today she left because facing life with no money was something she just couldn't do and raise four children. But it was until I came to Al-Anon before I got any sense of peace in that regard. My feelings toward her were love-hate. There was no in-between. And after I renewed the bond between us, or got to know her after I was grown and long after Buck and I were married, I learned to love her and accept her with the help of the Al-Anon program. But I didn't like her, and I don't feel guilty about that. We really didn't have very much in common. You know me, and when this meeting's over, you'll know me better than she ever did. And you have stood with me and walked with me and held my hand when she did not. And I expected more of this woman than she could give. And Al-Anon allowed me to release her in a loving way and no longer be bitter, and also release myself from the sense of responsibility that she left. These grandparents died within 7 months of one another when I was 11, and I became a ward of the Orphans Court at the State of Pennsylvania. And I don't know whether that law has changed up there or not, but until you were literally or actually 21 years of age, your legal status was babe in arms. And I found this a very lonely existence, and I spent a lot of years with the poor me's, you know, really did. And I don't share these things for you to feel sorry for me today, just to give you some background, because I feel that this loneliness and this feeling of being no good and being responsible for a lot of things I wasn't responsible for had a great influence in my staying through many years of active alcoholism. I think that I forfeited my right to reach out. I gave it up because of my sense of guilt. When I was 12 years of age, I was as tall as I am now. I wasn't as wide, but I was as tall, and I didn't fit in. I remember changing schools, and when I got to the new school, they thought I was the new teacher. You know, all the other kids could walk under my arms. I never went to a dance in my life if a guy didn't ask me to dance. He hit me right here. And I learned to dance stiff arm. I never was comfortable. I was always the one that was too loud. I laughed at the wrong things. I said the wrong things. I've always suffered from hoof and mouth disease. And when I came to Al-Anon, I stayed quiet, honestly, for a little while, because I had learned that you shared only what was acceptable to other people. And I hope we stay away from that in our program, that we don't do that to people, that we make them say only what we find acceptable in their sharing. When I was 17, I approached the Orphans Court and asked permission to leave Pennsylvania, and I went to Southern California. That was as far away as I could go from Pennsylvania. And I equated unhappiness and all with Pennsylvania. And I identify when I hear alcoholics talk about taking a geographical cure, because I was running from what I thought was the reason, and of course I took me with me, and me got off the train with me. I stayed out there some 3 years and had an opportunity to come to North Carolina, and very shortly thereafter I met Buck, and I chased him until he caught me, and I doubted my sanity for many years because of that. And after I came in the program, I doubted his sanity for catching me. And we started talking about getting married. And you see, I didn't know that I had the needs that I had. And I remember one Friday night, I had decided what I was going to say and how he was going to respond, and it was just going to be terrific. And I was going to say, Buck, I decided to go back to California. And he was going to say, oh no, don't go. So I said, Buck, I'm going back to California. And he said, when are you leaving? I thought, well, I'll show you, I'll leave, and I did. That's called false pride. But I sometimes forget to share that Buck came to California for me. I mustn't forget that. Sober too. And talking about knowing something leading us when we don't even realize it is. The day we were to be married, the night before the day we were to be married, I said, don't drink in the morning. Isn't that strange? Because he and I were drinking together anytime we wanted to. We ran with a drinking crowd, we partied a lot, and there weren't any problems. But something made me say that Saturday night, we were going to be married on a Sunday morning, don't drink in the morning. You know, that haunted me for years, too. And I let it haunt him. I made sure he remembered it, too. We were dirt poor. We worked hard. We did without. And we prospered in a modest way. We drank together. We were, as I say, we went with a partying crowd. We bought a small home, a very modest home. Two children were born to us. But things weren't like I thought they were going to be. Because I thought now, when Beck and I married, I have someone to love and someone to love me. And I had seen people with money and position and education that I thought were shallow and vain, and I didn't want to be like them. I'd seen people living in fine homes that when those doors were closed, it was terrible. I was not interested in those things. But it wasn't working out that way. And it was to be a long time before I got to Al-Anon and took a look at my life and the pattern of my life and the pattern of our lives. But there never was a sober Christmas. There was never those holiday times. I believe it was Venetia last night that said that everybody drinks at Christmas but not until Valentine's Day. He was a piker. Buck drank to St. Pat's. Oh, dear. These extended drunks that I didn't know were drunks. Buck always worked. He always went through the motions. It was to take me a long time to realize that when he asked me to be involved in business with him, it wasn't because of my intellect. It was because no one else would work for him. And he was able to use my sense of need to have someone to do his work for him when he wasn't able to. During the next years, the same things happened at our house that happened at yours. And I don't have to give you a blow-by-blow. The city may be different, the holiday different, the time, what was actually said, what actually took place. These can be as various and numerous as you and I. But what really happened to us and to me on the inside is the same as it happened to all of us. The sense of failure, the sense of guilt, the sense of, you know, thinking, what did I do wrong? And the terrible superstition. You know, I heard a lot of people say they never lost their faith in God. I don't know. I think I have more superstition than faith. You know, if Buck and I went out someplace and I wore a red polka dot dress and we didn't have a fight, I wore that dress till it nearly was in rags, you know. If I served a certain meal on a certain day of the week and we had had a blast because of it, a bad argument, I never served that on that day of the week again. You know, I didn't tempt the gods. I didn't run any risks. I used to say that in a nutshell, my life, the years of active alcoholism, that I had been knocked out and locked out and kicked out, ridiculed, rejected, shamed, and embarrassed. And this is true. But oh my, the revelation that comes to us in step four. I had done all of these things to him, and not necessarily when I was drinking. And I'm not proud of that, but I think it's important for me to remember that what happened was not just one way. The fact that Beck and I are still together after 36 years is a miracle. You know, we should have both killed one another. I don't know how we could have done it, but we came pretty close to. I'm not one of those soft-spoken women that I meet sometimes in Al-Anon meetings that say things like this that make me want to throw up. Like, he was passed out, but before I came to the meeting, I put a pillow under his head. And I think, ye gods, put a pillow under his head. I used to figure the one way, I thought of all different ways to kill him. You know, the gun, you know, the automobile accident. Could I drive that car toward the bridge and get out of the car before in time and they get him? Could I get the car to the brink and knock it out of gear and let it roll, you know? But the best one, the one I fantasized the most over, was a pillow. Passed out, my size, a pillow, on top of him, smother him, turn him over, facing the pillow, call him and say, he was drunk and came home and you see what's happened. But I knew that old boy, survival is a basic instinct in all of us. And I knew he'd come to and beat the socks off of me. I knew it. And the anger and the frustration and the sense of failure comes from what you can't do that you want to do. It also comes to me when you're doing what I want to do, but my conscience won't let me, but yours conscience will let you. It doesn't matter what you're doing. I'll take issue with what you're doing, and I'll be very self-righteous and very pious about it. But the real truth is I'd like to do it too, and my damn conscience won't let me. And I resent you being able to. I used to say at Al-Anon meetings when people would say, when my husband came home or what have you, I took money out of his pocket. Not I. I didn't stoop to that. Oh, I wanted to so bad. But somehow I couldn't do it. And I don't think it was conscience. It may have been part conscience, but another big part of it was that Buck vacillated between being a lover and a fighter. And he was both roles with me. You know, and I, and many times when I would take exception in what he'd say, I'd find it wasn't as important when I got up off the floor. Oh, and I tried my best. You know, I can't stand here and say that, I didn't want to knock him out. You damn betcha I wanted to. I threw things and, you know. I'm so glad I can laugh about that. I'm so glad I can talk about it in front of my husband, whether we're alone or in a group. God, thank you for the freedom from having to keep secrets from him. God, if I had to feel that I could only say things to you, but don't tell him, God, what? I wouldn't be free. Being able to share them or say them to somebody isn't the freedom in itself. The inventory step and the fifth step don't give us freedom just by the mechanics of it. You know, I'm so grateful for that. Well, anyhow, Beck and I had gotten married and we had two children and we were just, you know, living house to house, mouth to mouth, and grocery money was what was left over after we paid all the bills, you know, that sort of thing. And we had a chance to go into business for ourselves, and we were very successful. Now, two things happened. We moved to South Carolina, and two things happened primarily with that move. It gave me an opportunity to be somebody. Now, you can see how, regardless of how I impress you now, how deflated and much, how much of a failure I thought that I was, by helping to run a very modest business made you feel important, okay? But I loved to run the business, and I loved it even more when Buck wasn't around, because then I was sole boss, you know. I didn't have to consult him. All right, during that, giving him that freedom gave him time and money to drink as he wanted to. And any time I find my sense of security or satisfaction or fulfillment based in the wrong things, it's terminal. It won't last. And my self-acceptance and my self-image was based on what I was in that business, and of course it didn't last. Failure is all things are relative. It depends on our individual experiences what things mean. But I want to give you an example of what is failure in my life. Failure in my life is my husband gone for an extended period of time. And I go through that, oh God, where is he? I hope he's safe. The son of a, he's dead. I'm going to kill him. Oh, I hope he comes home. Oh, what am I going to say to the children? You know, the whole thing. And then deciding, all right, he's been gone this time. I've gotten along all right. When he comes home, I'm not going to fuss. I'm not going to argue. There's not going to be any more of that. I'm just going to ignore him, and I'm going about my life. And let him, because he'll be gone again, you know, in and gone and back. He says any time he ever came home was when we ran out of money, you know. So anyhow, so I decided this, and he returned. And I felt like a failure 6 weeks later when the doctor told me I was pregnant. That's failure. You're not going to speak to him, but you're pregnant. December 1958, Beck had been gone on an extended drunk, and I didn't know where he was. I had not been able to find a job in this town to support myself and our three children. Our business was long gone. I said I couldn't find a job in this town because of his reputation. That was a factor, but that wasn't the whole truth. I wasn't very employable either. If somebody told me Buck was at Papa Nash's at Myrtle Beach drinking, I had to go see if he was. And if it meant going to work or going to the beach to see if he was there, I went to the beach. If someone called and said, Buck wants you to come to wherever, I had to go. I could not go. I remember one time he was in the hospital for an extended period of time as a result of an automobile accident. And I remember the doctor saying to me, go home and take care of your children and yourself and let this man find himself. And I could not go. I don't know why. A part of it was what a good woman does. Isn't this really stupid? A good woman sits in a waiting room at a hospital where medically trained people take care of a patient, and the patient gets sleep and food and baths and attention, and you sit out there and get dirty and sweaty and grubby and sleepy and swollen and bleary-eyed and totally insane because you're good. You know, you don't want to be caught, any nurse coming down the hall or a doctor, and you not sitting there saying, his wife is still waiting, you know, still waiting. And you walk down the hall and you go in the room and you think, you son of a bitch, why don't you go ahead and die? You know, you're saying that good woman, you know. What others thought of me was more important. I had no real thoughts of self. Anything I thought about myself, I couldn't really look at. You know, it was like I'd look over here and see me over here. I couldn't really look at me. But everything was because of what was around me. And any sense of being all right, I think Venetia touched on this also, any sense of being all right was if you thought I was all right. You know, if you didn't criticize me. I didn't know who I was because when I was at work and my employer would say, we need you to stay late tonight, I couldn't say no. But during the night while I'd be working, I'd think, what about the children? I should be there. If I said no and went home, I think I should be at work. I shouldn't have said no. That terrible, you see, my feet and my head were never in the same place until I got to Al-Anon. Never. And in Al-Anon, I'm trying to learn, and it becomes easier. I'm able to do it more frequently than ever before. But my feet are here, so let's get my head here for right now. Because I'm not going to change anything by my head being away from here, except that I'll miss what's happening now. And so to try and do that is helpful. We had lost everything that we had when we moved back to Charlotte at Christmas Eve. And like Buck says, when you see a family moving on Christmas Eve or New Year's or Mother's Day or the 4th of July, there's something wrong someplace, you know. We moved, and I thought it couldn't get any worse. That's a phrase I try to avoid because it can always be worse. I was telling Alice earlier this morning, I was chastising myself for being discontent or finding fault with some very trivial things. And I thought to myself, oh girl, your life's pretty good if you have time to consider that. Pretty doggone good, you know. And how significant, how as our problems become smaller and smaller, our lives are really better. And yet I don't recognize that. And I can make a big deal out of something that isn't worth a hill of beans. And I catch myself at it sometimes. Sometimes Buck catches me at it. And I wish he'd mind his own business and work his own program, you know. Of course, I don't feel that way when I catch him at it. I mean, after all. In 1967, one lunchtime, I went in to fix lunch. Now, part of that I was that I was thrifty. And thrifty meant that you saved bread wrappers and tin foil and string and boxes, gift wrap, clothes, tin cans, mayonnaise jars, anything and everything you saved because you were thrifty. And I knew that if you saved anything 7 years, you would definitely have a use for it within those 7 years. And I was sure it was in the Bible someplace, but I didn't know where. But I saved everything. I didn't know until I came to Al-Anon what really was fear in action. My inability to accept or believe that if I would do to the best of my ability what I should do one day at a time, that my higher power, God as I understand him, will provide for me according to my needs. I started to come to understand that God will provide, but I missed that needs, and I was still unhappy because I thought it said meet your wants, but it said needs, and I had still another learning experience. But anyhow, this lunchtime, in an old mayonnaise jar, I had some leftover salad. Now, you don't throw away anything until it's green. And I had some salad with oil and vinegar dressing. Anybody made salad with oil and vinegar, you know it's sad as the devil right away, but I'd saved it. And I reached in to get the jar, and I tucked it under my arm, and I leaned over to get something else, and the lid wasn't secure, and the salad went over the kitchen floor. And I reacted in what was normal for me, tone of voice and expression. I'll try and keep the volume down, but I assure you this is not the volume it was at. Good God, what else? That damn drunk and now this mess. And then I thought, he's not drunk. He's waiting for me to fix lunch. He's in the living room. How long has it been since he's been drunk? What's he been doing? And that afternoon was a traumatic experience for me. I can't remember everything I thought, but I can remember a lot of it like it was yesterday. I remember thinking,
He's been coming home every night, sober. He's been coming home when he said he'd come home. I'd like to digress right here and say to any alcoholics here, if you want to make amends to your family in a most meaningful way that they will not appreciate at the onset, but finally it will come to them, is do what you say you'll do when you say you'll do it. That doesn't cost anything. But that damn near blew my mind when I realized he was coming home when he said he would. And I thought, there's been sober people coming by here to see him. Not me, but him. And sober people are calling him. I knew they were sober. I can smell a drunk on the phone any day. And I thought, where is it he said he had been going? What was it? What is it? What was that deal he said he was doing? And then I thought, I'll bet he hasn't told them what a good wife I've been to him. How I've stood by him through thick and thin. So, of course, you know, I'm on the defensive. And then I'm mad. And I'm angry. And I'm resentful. Because it's dawned on me that something I had believed for a long time was not true. I had believed for a long time if he would get sober, we will be all right. And he had, and my life hadn't changed a bit. You know, living in active alcoholism is like being out in a small boat. You're standing up to fish in a small boat. You keep your knees flexed, and you roll with the water. Okay? You like this. This is living with an active drunk. Then they go in AA and get sober, but hell, you're still standing there going like this. You know? We hadn't gone anyplace together in a long time. I couldn't even say to Buck, I know now. You know that I didn't know any of this as it was happening. You do know it's only as a result of repeated inventory that I've come to know any of these things. I couldn't say to Buck, I need some money, because he might say, I couldn't care less. And I couldn't be out on that limb and have him saw it off. I couldn't say to him when we crawl in bed at night, I couldn't reach out and touch him and let him know that I might like a little loving, because he might roll over and give me a cold shoulder, and I couldn't risk that. I couldn't say, as he'd start out, I'd like to go with you, and have him say, I don't want you. I knew it was there. I knew it was there, but I didn't want to hear it. I didn't want it really spotlighted. I just couldn't risk it. But that afternoon, I thought, you know, drunk or sober, I'm still sitting here every night running this lousy business, and he's still doing his thing. And that got me grassroots mad. And I thought, well, I'm going too. I didn't know for sure where he was going, but that didn't make a damn. I'd been in jail with him. I'd called the bootleggers. I said I was going to be good this morning. By good, I mean behave. You know. Oh, dear. Anyhow, I decided I was going along. And that night, about 7:30, Buck's lighting his pipe, and he said, well, I'll see you about 9:30 or 10. And I'd gotten dressed right quick, you know, and I said, well, I'm going too. And I could have killed him, because he said, all right, come on. He didn't let me, didn't argue with me yet. Well, because when Buck and I were drinking together and I didn't get into the trouble he did, I figured it was because I was smarter than he was, or better character, you know, finer by family, you know. And that was why. And this is fertile ground for being a know-it-all. And a know-it-all can't say, where are we going? Or I don't know. You know. So when I went out and got in the car, I couldn't say, where are we going? Because then he would know I didn't know, and I damn sure didn't want him to know I didn't know. That was very important. So I'm like a blowfish out of water, and we go across town, and we pull up in front of this building, and we get out, and we walk in. And he pointed to a stairwell, and he said, They meet down there. Now, I didn't know who they were, but you know I wasn't going to ask him. I asked anybody. And I went down. Okay, a lot of things. This is funny to tell. And I can enjoy it now. I did not enjoy it while it was happening. But you know what was happening? The God of my understanding was taking care of me. Just think what might have happened if I'd gotten to an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous first. You know, I'd been one of those non-alcoholic members of AA meetings. You know, they're not AA, and they're not Al-Anon, and they sit on the fence, and they cause a hell of a lot of trouble for everybody. You sit around coffee tables, and everybody's talking, you know, and somebody says something, and they'll say, "Well, how long have you been sober, honey?" And she'll say, "Oh, I'm not an alcoholic." And right away somebody said, "That's just like an Al-Anon." I want to say, "Hell no, that's not Al-Anon." You know, alcoholics... there's something we need to, all of us, I think, work on. I do realize I need to work on it, and I try to. Alcoholic and anonymous, and Al-Anon are not compatible. It's AA and Al-Anon. It's alcoholic and non-alcoholic. Every AA member's spouse is not an Al-Anon. A marriage license does not make you a member of Al-Anon any more than the spouses and family members of Al-Anon members are AAs and they're out there in the ditch drunk this morning. And I've got another point I want to mention here about anonymity. I love when I hear the Al-Anon anonymity statement read. Too many times, it's better than none at all, but the AA anonymity statement is read at functions. But I would implore everyone here present to think for one moment about anonymity in this regard. I don't know of any, I know many alcoholics, if their anonymity was violated, that their livelihood would be in jeopardy. But I don't know any alcoholic whose anonymity, his membership in AA being disclosed, would jeopardize his life. But I know Al-Anon members whose lives are threatened when their anonymity is violated. So when we speak of protecting anonymity, you may be protecting a life when you respect the anonymity of Al-Anon members. It's very important, believe me. Anyhow, I went downstairs and I went into the meeting and I was like an alcoholic, and still can be, when I'm in uncertain territory. You know, an alcoholic's been in a blackout will be very attentive when they come out of it, because they don't remember what went on. And they'll be so nice to you, and they will just listen to every word you had to say, and you think, "I'm getting through to him. Ah, and all he wants to know is what happened that he doesn't remember, see?" Well, people that don't know it all but need to know it all but get in situations that they don't know about will do the same damn thing. They will be very quiet and listen attentively. And so I sat and I listened. And some things happened that night for which I'm very grateful. Now, I told you that I feel that God was working in my life, that I got there that night and it was an Al-Anon meeting and a closed AA meeting, and I got to Al-Anon. There's no doubt in my mind, and I'm sure that you will say, a coincidence, that night there was a gal named Ann that got up and shared. And I've been to a lot of Al-Anon meetings since, and I've never seen Ann again. Never seen her again. It was sufficient that she was in one room for 1 hour of one night to open a door for one person, and that person was me. And I'm very grateful to Ann. She's still active in Al-Anon. I hear of her. She's moved from North Carolina, lives in Florida, all this sort of thing. I've never bumped into her again, but that's all right. Ann told me that night that I wasn't alone. She didn't say those words to me, but she talked. She stood up and she shared, and I knew I wasn't alone. I thought she was crazy, but I knew I was, so that made two of us. I wasn't alone, and I was attracted. When I went into that room, I started talking to this lady, this aunt. I didn't know she was the speaker or had the program that night, didn't know anything, knew nothing about Al-Anon, didn't know I was in an Al-Anon meeting, nothing, just trivial conversation. The members of that group, Ann was a visitor there that night, came from another group to talk. The people saw me talking to her, thought I'd come to the meeting with her. Ann, who was a visitor, thought I was a member of the group. So there wasn't that that we get so concerned with, the newcomer welcome. A newcomer welcome isn't worth a damn if we don't offer a program that sticks to our purpose of being. And in that meeting that night, she comforted me and she made me feel welcome. And I was attracted and I came back. There was never any doubt about coming back. I don't know. God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. He made me aware. He just covered me, blanketed me with acceptance that I didn't even know I was practicing. Started going to meetings there on a regular basis, and after I'd been there a while, one of the ladies said, "We don't know what Al-Anon group you've been attending, but we're so glad that you joined us." I said, "I've never been to Al-Anon before." And no, they were, you know, but they didn't need to be dismayed. The meeting had stuck to the purpose. And if we stick to the purpose of our meetings, whatever, whether it be an AA meeting, and I know I have no business referring to AA, but if we stick to the purpose of our Al-Anon LT meetings, we will never violate a tradition. The traditions only came along because you and I are humans, and we can't stick to just one thing. We've got to be all things to all people, you know. Anyhow, I started, and I wondered who's talked to Ann. Everybody was, it was secret then. I wanted to talk to this Ann again. I didn't know I could go to somebody and say, "Hey, do you know how I can get in touch with Ann?" It were, you know, there was no last names, you know, so secret, you know. Anyhow, I thought, oh, if I could only talk to Ann again, or I could talk to Ann. I'd never talked to her, I'd just heard her. And then I went to the first conference that we ever attended, and I heard a lady there, and she really opened a door for me. She really did. Another door. And I thought, oh, if I could only get to talk to her. And I never will, because I've never gotten to talk with Ann. But, you know, our paths have crossed many, many times in intervening years, and we've had many opportunities to share. She said, and I remembered it, and it sent me home from the meeting with a goal. She said that she would go to Al-Anon meetings for the sole purpose of dumping her garbage. That's all Al-Anon was to her, a dumping ground. And she said there was one lady who would always listen to her very lovingly. And she said after she would dump all her garbage, the lady invariably would say to her, "Have you tried the steps?" She said she got so tired of hearing that, she decided, "I'm going home, I'll do those damn steps." And when she asked me, I'd say, "Yes, and they don't work." So that was her approach. So she went home and she started working on the steps. And she said, "Doggone, if it didn't work." I thought, wow, I want something to work in my life. So I went home and I started studying the steps, and I've been studying them since. I wish that I had the dedication to the studying of the steps that I had in the first 3 years. But the further I am removed from problems, the less dedicated I am to study. Anyhow, I started, and I think I have about 20 minutes. Is that right, Bob? No, they really won't bring lunch over. Sorry, I wasn't going to tell you to write at the last, but no, the mind can absorb no more than the seat can endure. And I know that, because I've been sitting. Anyhow, I started studying the steps, and I want to share with you how I study the steps, the procedure. You know, I'm not very bright, and I need you when you say you bake a cake, don't hand me a recipe. Let me stand beside you and watch you do it. Tell me what size bowl you use. Or if you're going to wash the car, don't tell me I use such and such. Show me what kind of cloth you use or what brush, which part of the car you wash first. That's how I can learn. So that's why I'm going to share how I go about the steps. I take everything I can find, and oh, this is going to be sacrilegious. I take AA literature too. And I put everything on step one, and I close up the book, and I come to conclusions about that step at that time. And then I go on, and I read everything on step two that I can, and I close it, and I think about what I've read and what I've heard, and I come to conclusions about that step at that time, and I go on. And I went through the steps and through the steps and through the steps with this approach, and then I woke up one day and realized I was ready to start using the steps and putting action into them, not just thinking about them, not just considering them, not just trying to understand them. The first step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, and our lives had become unmanageable. I rejected that I was powerless over alcohol. I could take a drink or leave it alone. I rejected Al-Anon groups that said we were powerless over the alcoholic, because that's not step one of the 12 steps of AA, and our purpose says that we go by the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a lot of trouble admitting I was powerless over alcohol. Then I realized that I was more powerless over alcohol than the alcoholic, because I can't refuse the first drink for him. And I'm indeed powerless over alcohol. But not just that, I'm powerless over time and place and circumstance. With just the first step, I can't even dig a hole and crawl in, because I am powerless. There's no God for me in the first step. It tells me I am powerless, my life is unmanageable. And I thought the ultimate of failure. And then I realized, no, the opening door of freedom. It narrows the world down to what is my responsibility. Now, I don't always want my world narrowed down. My family doesn't always want my world narrowed down. My family likes to emotionally blackmail me into being responsible for things in their lives when they don't want to be responsible. But they always fail to tell me when to nib out, and then I'm in trouble because I'm still in there when they want me out. So I found out the best thing to do is just stay the hell out all the time, you know. I found out that this first step freed me from being responsible for, either through shame or assumption of any action for another person. It also told me you are what you are because you are what you are and not because of anybody else, and I didn't want that either. I wanted to be like I was. I wanted you to know the tragedies in my life. I wanted you to know all these sad things so you'd let me off the hook. Because if you knew my sad story, you'd say, no wonder Virginia's like she is, you know. But Virginia's like she is as long as she stays like she is, you know. The second step says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I came to believe in people first. I came to believe not in AA's, not in Al-Anon's, but in people in the program. And when something helps me today, I don't know whether I read it from in anything from AA or from Al-Anon or from an AA or from an Al-Anon. But you see, I believe God is the ultimate source of help for me, and people are channels. So it really isn't important to me what or who was the channel. And I try not to put responsibility on people that have been a channel at one time to always be my channel. I expect too much of them when I do that. You know, I come to you and you really help me today. That doesn't mean that you're always going to be in a position to give me what I need. It's unfair to you and it's unfair to me. So I must one day at a time seek and listen to the various channels around me. I learned this, and the Al-Anon helped me so much, and this is what relieved me of the painful memory of my mother. You see, I thought when I'd see you, any of you, with your mothers or with your children, you had something I didn't have and I wanted it, and that was something unique wasn't available except in that relationship. And after I found out where my mother was again and I tried to develop this relationship, it didn't develop. And I was, you know, I had put all my eggs in that basket, and I was caught with a basket full of eggs. But then when I was willing to accept what God had for me from whatever source he chose to bring it to me, then I had in abundance what I'd been looking for all my life. And I mean it when I say you're my family, because you are. You understand me, unfortunately too well most of the time. You love me more than I love myself. You accept me by far more than I accept myself. You don't tolerate me. You're my family. You're what I looked for in that relationship that didn't come. But it was here for me when I was willing to accept it where God provided it. I didn't have any questions being needed to be restored to sanity. You know, I used to get in the car and go looking for Buck with a hammer and a screwdriver and a wrench.
I found that Carl was going to fix it. And then when he came out of that dive or came back with that girlfriend and Carl wouldn't crank, by God, I'd be able to sit there and I'd say, that's what you get. And I'd find the car and I couldn't do it. You know, I would feel such a failure. Now that in itself isn't so important as what I must accept of myself, in that while I was off on those little trips of looking and finding the car and all, I left 3 children at home alone to care for themselves. My responsibility unmet and unfulfilled. And I cannot change that. The third step says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. I thought it was very simple. I thought you just said, God, do I do this or I do that, you know. But I found out that it's much more than that, because the body can be any place, but the will may not be with you and not be in tune with what's going on around you. I had to decide that, and I reached that point, and the first time I shared this, the man that I was talking to said to me, my God, you're the martyr of all martyrs. And I said, let me finish. You know that prayer that says, God, grant me victory over my difficulties, that it will be evidence to others of thy power. And I thought to myself one day, God, it's all right not to be relieved of my difficulties if it'll serve your purpose. And that's when this man said, boy, and I said, let me finish. I no sooner had that feeling, total, like water rushing over your body, you know, through every being, I knew it wasn't necessary. It wasn't necessary. You know, we hear people talking about willing to go to any lengths. I envision sackcloth and ashes. What were we going to do with all our time? What? No one has fun unless you drink. You know, all this kind of stuff. What we envision as being necessary rarely is. But what I found out was necessary, I don't want to do always. And that's another rub. But I found out if it's for God, it's all right. And if it's Virginia, it's wrong. It's wrong for Virginia to try to connive and manipulate things that are good for other people. And by I mean things that are really not harmful to people. It's just as bad for me to try and control that as to wish them ill or to try and trip them up and harm them. You know, we hear a lot, all of us, about taking inventory and all this kind of stuff. I wonder, am I not taking your inventory if I say to you, you're doing a great job? I say, boy, you're doing lousy. People say, don't take her inventory. But if I say, you're doing great, nobody thinks anything of it, do they? But is that not inventorying too? And is not the admonition not to take inventory, taking inventory and giving advice? Think about it. But I made a decision to the best of my ability that I became willing and I wanted to do what God would have me do, and that I would always seek that, because I knew in the final analysis the bottom line was what God had for me would be best for me all along, and that I might acquire and achieve and do a lot of things by my own endeavors and the result of my own action. But if they weren't God-oriented and God's plan, I still would not be happy with it, nor would it bring me what I wanted. I could not have prayed for what I found in this program because I didn't know it existed. And yet if God had granted any prayer I might have prayed before the day I arrived here, how much I would have shortchanged myself. So this prayer says, God, whatever you have for me, this step says, whatever you have for me. And then how to put action into this, how to bring about this, what to do with this life, and how to know what to do with this will. In the following steps, and starting with 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I think it's very important for me to remember that it's supposed to be fearless, not fearful. And it is an inventory, and an inventory means that you catalog everything that is, and you don't decide as you're putting it down if it's good, bad, or indifferent. You just put it down, and then when you review it, you put it where it belongs. It's something to be strengthened and nourished and to grow, or something to pray for guidance to be relieved of. But on putting it down on paper for me, I don't try and determine what it is at the time, whether it's good or bad and different, something desirable or undesirable, what character defect it is or isn't, what attribute, you know, all that stuff. I just sit down and I write it and I put it down. And then in review, I find out. I found out the meanings of a lot of words in step four because I found out a lot of people used words and they meant something different than what I thought when I heard the word. And so I looked up a lot of words and I found out the difference between pleasure and happiness and caused and contributed and standards and principles and many, many things that helped me a great deal. I took this written inventory and I admitted to God, to myself and another human being, the exact nature of the wrongs that I had found in step four. And at the onset of step five, I thought, why do I have to admit to God? You've told me that God knows me better than I know myself. And then I realized it's just like everything else in the program. It isn't for God's benefit that I do the admitting. It's for mine. It's for mine that I admit to God, to myself and another human being. And in doing this, I had the sense of really coming home. I had the sense, now not with my first one was a farce. I backed off because the lady with whom I chose to take it, her eyebrows started going up into her hair and I backed off, you know. Of course, I think I was unwise in my selection. This was a lady that didn't drink, didn't smoke, she didn't cuss, she went to church all the time. And she could say constantly, and I love her dearly to this day, but I just can't relate to this. I love him so much I could eat him with a spoon. Oh, I love my husband, but hell, I ain't gonna eat him with any spoon. And see, so I was unwise in the person whom I chose. But later I had a very painful, but very enriching experience in taking a fifth step with a lady that when I would reach a point that I couldn't go on would share herself with me. And you know, a lot of us talk about things, oh, that's not Al-Anon. Where's the gal from Fairmont? That's not Al-Anon. There are a lot of things. But if you say the word salvation, I've said it now, that's not Al-Anon. It's in the literature. You know what salvation means? It means to come home. That's what it means, to come home. And I had the sense of coming home because another human being knew as much about me as I could remember, and she wasn't looking at me with hate or rejection. She put her arms around me and hugged me and told me to go in the other room. I was spending time at her house with her. And she told me what to do, and I went apart. And I approached then step six, which come entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. And for me, this step has caused the greatest problem. I've had the least sense of something to hold on in this step. And I think it's probably because I've had the greatest problem with self-acceptance. And in this step I have learned, or I know that I must be patient and accept slow progress. And I must accept the fact there are things that I am not and never will be and get on with it. And that the very best effort on my part, I'm still going to fail. I think I joined the human race with step six. And step seven says we're entirely ready. No, it doesn't. It says we humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. And a lot of people I've heard say, if you mention humility, you have none. When they say that to me, I say, don't say love to me. Don't say gratitude to me. Because if you do, you have none. You cannot isolate one thing and say, if you mention it, you don't have it, and then it's all right to mention the others. Because then I can say hate, and I won't have any, will I? I can say resentment, I won't have any, will I? It doesn't hold water. But the reason who mentioned humility doesn't hold water to me is because humility to me is honesty. You see, honestly, I don't deserve or have earned the right to be here this morning. I don't deserve or earn being well-fed, nobody laugh, being well-fed, clothed, housed, loved, accepted. I don't deserve for God to have done for me and been as good to me as he had. I don't deserve for that man to not hate me and walk off and never come back. I don't deserve for our children to return to us and have the relationship that we have today. And that humbles me. That recognizing that truthfully. And I don't care how well educated you are, and I don't care how fancy dressed you are, and I don't care how worldly wise you are and traveled, and I don't care how many high muckety-mucks you'll know, and I don't care how many low bottoms you go see. You ain't no more than what you are, no matter where you live or how you dress or where you went to school or anything else. And neither am I. So I humbly ask God. The eighth step made a list of persons we'd harmed. The list started in step four and became willing to make amends to them all. And step nine made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. It is not loving or godly to ease my guilty conscience at your expense. That's simple. Step 10, continue to take a personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. My fourth step inventory is written. My tenth step is not. But if I don't do it on a regular basis, it has to become part of a written one. I think they knew I was coming when they said promptly. But I find out that this is where the real selfish part of the program sets in for me. Because if I don't do it, I hurt. I'm uncomfortable. I feel depression. I feel out of step. You know, I can be so mad at you, I could wring your neck. You don't even know it, maybe. But I'm just churning over it, you know. So it's for my benefit that I do this. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry it out. I call this the happiness step. And I love the word sought. You know, it doesn't mean found. What if the step said found through these steps? We wouldn't do a damn thing but just sit from now on, would we? But sought means we keep on looking. And the little glimpses of it that we find motivate us to keep on. To improve. You cannot improve on something you don't have. And I think if we have done as best we can with the preceding 10, we will have found something whether we recognize it yet or not. Praying only for knowledge of his will for us. I've heard people say, you don't talk to God about a car or a house. Well, I think it's pretty stupid if I'm trying to decide about a car just to turn that off and think God doesn't know I'm concerned about that. I don't pray to God for a car, if that's something I'm considering. I pray to God for knowledge if I should proceed about the car. If I'm considering doing something that's different, I'll not God let me do it, but God show me, should I? And if it's something I really can't resolve, I pray to God to put insurmountable objects in front of me so that I will hear him, because I cannot been able to discern it within myself. And step 12, having had a spiritual awakening, as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to others and practice these principles in all our affairs. I have had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. If you had written my obituary 15 years ago, it would be no different today. Lived the same place, had the same number of children, owned the same business, married to the same man. Nothing's changed, but a lot has changed. And there's hope for change, even more change, that I can assure you, sometimes I get so happy and I have so much fun and I get so high. I know I walked in a room this weekend and I could see people, I saw one person kind of go like this, like they were embarrassed for me. And I thought, darling, I'm not on an ego trip. I'm really not. I'm just having a ball. And God told me he wants me to be happy. And because I can have fun and cut up and other people are quieter, it's been very hard for me to accept. It really has. It's very hard for me to accept the role of Mrs. S.O.B. when they violate traditions at meetings. But I love Al-Anon more than I love you loving me. And so I'll speak up. Because if Al-Anon survives, my source, my human source of help is available to me. And God's channels will be available to me. I'm very jealous of Al-Anon. God damn, don't you mess it up. Don't you dare mess it up. Someplace it's written that the last shall come first, and the last of the last of the 12th step. Practice these principles in all your affairs. That's a word I looked up too. You know what practice means? To teach through repetition, by doing repeatedly. So baby, if you're bored with hearing the steps, if you're bored with going to meeting, if you're bored with people talking about being witchy or drunk and all this and getting better and ain't great life great, and you're bored to death, you're just bored with life. Because every day we get up at some time or another, it may be you may be sick and get up at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning, you may be well on the road to recovery and get up about noon. Moon. Oh. It's hard to practice the principles in all my affairs. It's hard for me to always know what's my will and what God's will. It's hard for me to remember, you know, God fill my mouth with worthwhile stuff and nudge me when I've said enough. You know, I've got bruised ribs. It's hard for me to get the message. God needs strong with me, you know. Beck and I are getting along as well as could be expected. And by that, I do not mean that in a down sense. We did a lot of things to one another. We've come a long way. And there's a long way ahead, one day at a time. And it's all right. I can talk and remember about things in the past, and they don't hurt me in here. And I pray, God, that my actions and the memory of things for him don't hurt him in here. But if they do, I can't do anything about it. He has got to find that peace for himself. Our children, as I say, have a very good relationship. I'm very active in Al-Anon. I go to regular group on a regular basis. And they step on my toes when I need it. And sometimes they love me enough not to, and they think it's loving me. I want to close with some lines that someone else wrote. I don't have the sense of really saying a doggone thing this morning, but these lines that someone else wrote kind of wrap it all up for me. I know not what the future holds of marvel or surprise. I'm assured alone that life and death, God's mercy underlies. And if my heart and flesh are weak to bear an untried pain, the bruised reed he will not break, but strengthen and sustain. No offering of my own I have, nor works my faith to prove. I can but give the gift he gave and plead his love for love. I know not where God's islands lift their fronded palms in air. I only know I cannot drift beyond his love and care. And my dear friends, if my faith is vain, and if these hopes betray, pray for me that I may find a surer, safer way. And thou, O Lord, who knows thy creatures as they be, forgive me if too close I lean my human heart to thee. Thank you very much for what I have today.